Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, for about a century, we have been fortifying at least some of our foods. It's been seen as a powerful tool in the world of nutrition, where essential vitamins, minerals, and nutrients are added to foods to improve their nutritional value. It's a strategy that has the potential to address some global health challenges, such as vitamin deficiencies, and there are new developments happening right now. In the UK, the government wants to add folic acid to some types of wheat or flour, with the aim of reducing birth defects in babies. But how effective is fortification? Who should decide which foods are fortified and with what? What about people who don't want anyone messing with their food? And what does the future hold for fortified foods? Well, I'm delighted to welcome back to the podcast an absolutely fabulous guest. Dr. Carrie Ruxton is a dietitian, health writer, and TV nutritionist. Hello there, Carrie.
Hi there, Stefan. It's good to be back.
It's great to have you back again. Okay, well, let's just sort of start by going back in time a little bit. What are some of the earliest examples of food being fortified on either a wide or a national scale?
Well, we have to zoom over to America to find one of the first instances of food fortification. And what they decided to do in Ohio, which is very far from the sea, was to put iodine in salt. And that was because children at the time were developing a deficiency to iodine, which is called goiter. And that's when you have a very enlarged neck. In fact, we used to have it in England as well. There was, I can't remember which part of England it was, but there used to be a particular neck that was kind of rural people living in a certain part of England. I think it was Derbyshire. Derbyshire neck was actually a thing, and it was goiter, where people were not getting enough iodine. And now the places that you get iodine are fish and seafood, and you also get some from the soil too. And in the past, you used to be able to get iodine from milk because they would sanitize the cow's teats with an iodide antibacterial wash. That then came into the milk. You could call it contamination or you could call it fortification, but came into the milk. And so people who drank milk were able to get some form of iodine. But zooming back to America again, this was in the 1920s when they decided to do that. And it was very successful at getting rid of goiter and iodine deficiency in children. And other examples, for example, if you look at the UK, is flour fortification. So the 1940s, particularly in the post-war years, were a period of great enlightenment for nutrition, where we really started to think about the health of our nation and the amazing role that nutrition could play in that. One of the things they decided to fortify, because it was so widely used, was flour. And it was white flour, because that's what most people were having at the time. And they started to fortify it with calcium, iron, and B vitamins, particularly niacin and thiamine as well, which are B vitamins. And that helped to overcome vitamin deficiencies at that time.
And do we know the sort of levels of success that these projects achieved? I mean, did it have a tangible positive impact on public health?
Yes, it did. Although I have to say, you have to look at what sort of evidence. So if we want to know whether something from a nutritional perspective is having an impact on health, first of all, it's got to be eaten. It's got to have sufficient nutrients at a level that is going to have an impact. Then you need to look at intakes. So you need to monitor intakes of people using dietary surveys. But intakes are not the same as nutritional status, although a lot of people mix them up. So you then have to look at blood levels of nutrients to see whether people are able to consume the nutrient and it is going into their body. After you've done that, you then need to look at health markers. So something like goiter, where you're looking for a visual sign or you're measuring something, could be stunting, growth, body weight. It could be signs of scurvy, It could be skin, you know, your skin condition, because there's so many things that vitamins and minerals have an impact on. And then the end point would be, is it reducing disease? And we're going to come on to folic acid in a moment, but the disease that we're trying to reduce with folic acid fortification is neural tube disorders, and one of these is spina bifida. So we do have evidence at most of these stages. We know that when people eat fortified foods, for example, ready-to-eat breakfast cereals, which have been fortified in the UK for decades now, we do know that they're getting more iron, they're getting more B vitamins, and more recently, they're obtaining things like vitamin D from fortified cereals, because that's a new nutrient that's been put into these cereals. We also have data, particularly from Ireland, that shows that the folic acid that you add to things like breakfast cereals is getting into the blood. And we also have data from Canada and America to show that levels of neural tube disorders have reduced significantly, sometimes by between 50 and 70%. When people have an adequate, it is absolutely huge from a folic acid perspective, what you can do for neural tube disorders. So, in fact, it was estimated by scientists that if we brought it into the UK in 1998, we could have prevented 2,000 pregnancies with neural tube disorders. So that is, you know, many families with heartache, perhaps who've had terminations or who have had a severely disabled child. And that could have been prevented simply by adding a nutrient into flour. So when it's used correctly, fortification can be a very powerful, positive source.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned scurvy just now, and I wondered, is there a sort of definition of fortification? Because scurvy was sort of conquered with people, generally speaking, with people eating citrus fruits to begin with. That's not really food fortification. So what's the difference between that and fortification? Is there a notional difference, a tangible difference in how the nutrient is delivered?
Yes, absolutely, Stefan. So fortification is when you're adding to a food. So you may be putting in a nutrient that's not normally present in the food. Or so an example would be adding calcium, or even to rice, if you think about rice fortification, because that goes on a lot in lower and middle income countries. Rice is a food which contains a lot of carbohydrate and not much else, unless you're having whole grain rice. So they add vitamin A, B12, iron, zinc and folic acid to rice. Now, these nutrients, particularly something like B12, and zinc, are not naturally present in rice, so you're adding something. But you can also add to increase the composition of a naturally occurring nutrient. So that might be adding extra calcium into a yogurt, for example. So fortification can be either of those things, but you referred to scurvy, and that was getting your vitamin C from a natural source, which was citrus fruits.
It's a separate idea, and so I've worked in refugee camps and places where World Food Programme rations are delivered, and there seems to be a huge amount of fortification in the flours that they hand out. Are there the rice version that you mentioned? It sounds important as well. Are these the most common examples of food fortification around the world?
Yes, it definitely would be. So it would be things like rice and also skimmed milk or milk powders. They probably don't skim them if they're using them in lower income countries, because you want to get the maximum calories. But adding it to the foods that could be dried, transported, because you got to think, you know, if you're taking food to places where there are food shortages, you don't want something that's going to go off. So it's better to add fortification to things that you can preserve for a long period of time. So that would tend to be dry goods like cereals, which are very commonly fortified, and milk powders.
Yeah. Now, I guess we have to talk about this. Are there any risks associated with fortifying food on a mass scale? Because once you've fortified it, it's out of your control. You're delivering it to people and they eat it in various different ways with their own various versions of nutritional problems. So can you over-fortify food? Can you cause any other sorts of problems by delivering fortified ingredients?
Yeah, because there's risks associated with nutrition at all levels, whether you're fortifying or not. So take something as simple as water. There's the right amount of water that we need in our lives and in our diets. So if you get too little water, you will be dehydrated. And if that continues, then that can be a toxic event where you can actually die of severe dehydration. And many people do around the world. There's the right amount of water, which is quite a broad range and depends on many factors, your own personal requirements, physical activity, whether you're in a warm or cold climate. And then there can actually be too much water. So people who have, for example, some underlying mental health conditions or who are under the influence of certain drugs can overdrink water, which then leads to low salt levels in the blood and can lead to brain swelling and death. And it's no different with any other nutrient, particularly the fat-soluble nutrients, because the body will tend to store these. Things like vitamin A, for example, you have to be careful not to have too much of that in the diet. Iron as well can be a problem. In some parts of the world, people use iron cooking pots, so they end up with toxic levels of iron in their bodies. For fortification, we just have to estimate the correct level for that particular population. So that will mean looking at the amounts of that food eaten. So if you're fortifying something commonly used like flour, then obviously that's going to be eaten in fairly large amounts by a large proportion of people. And so experts can estimate the amount of vitamin or mineral to add to that product to make sure that we stay within the safe limits. We call these the tolerable upper limits, and they're calculated to be well below the level that does actually cause symptoms. So when somebody is at the limit and they're eating that every single day of their life, that is actually still safe because it is many times lower than the level that scientists have shown symptoms to appear. So in fact, there are risks for fortification, just as they are for every other nutrient in our diets, but we can mitigate those risks by making sure that we put the correct levels in. Another risk with some forms of fortification is certain groups who are more sensitive to a nutrient, or where the nutrient can mask other symptoms. So one of the concerns that's been raised over the 30 so years when we've been discussing folic acid fortification is that elderly people are particularly prone to B12 deficiency. And that's not because they're not getting enough in the diet, it's because they are lacking a particular, we call it the intrinsic factor in the stomach, which makes the vitamin B12 in the diet bioavailable. So they could be eating loads of vitamin B12, it's just not getting into their body. Yeah. And if you give somebody with B12 deficiency folic acid, it can then mask their vitamin B12 deficiency, and then it becomes too late to do anything about it. And you end up with loss of feeling in the fingers and toes, you get neurological problems. But that can be mitigated. So I actually don't think that is an excuse for not doing anything about the thousands of neural tube disorder pregnancies that are occurring in the UK. I think it isn't an excuse to say, well, we can't do anything about it because some elderly people might have, loss of feeling in their fingers, because we can mitigate that by saying elderly people more likely to get B12 deficiency. Let's test them, check them out for vitamin B12 deficiency and make sure that we're doing something about that, because you can actually give them medications that can help overcome that. Whereas somebody who is born with spina bifida has had no choice in the matter. There isn't any opportunity to mitigate for that person's health. And once you've been born with spina bifida, that is a lifelong health condition. Yeah. So I think that there are benefits and risks, but if the risk be mitigated and the risks are smaller than the benefits, then in my view, you go ahead with the fortification.
Yeah. Now, just, I mean, as I'm sure you remember, I'm obsessed with the systems of food additives, and I'm fascinated by how they work. Are these the fortification? Is it basically run under the food additive system, so the E number system, where we get the sort of safe working levels, or is it a bit more complex than that?
I'm not sure, actually, Stefan. I know that they will have E numbers because all vitamins that are added to food will have an E number. And you're absolutely right. People get terrified of E numbers, but in fact, it can be something as simple as vitamin C.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it we don't have to worry about it. I would presume that if it was given an E number, then it would be it would come under the regulations relating to additives because it is being added to a product. It's not naturally present and it's not in a supplement. So, but definitely, whatever you add to food, food still has to be safe. And in the UK, food safety is looked after by the Food Standards the Food Standards Organisation in England and Wales, and Food Standards Scotland up here in Scotland, the Food Standard Agency in England and Wales. These organisations take their role incredibly seriously. They would simply not allow something that wasn't safe. And in the rest of Europe, of course, we have the European Food Safety Authority, which still does a lot of excellent work in this area.
Yeah. Now, I think we should also talk about there is a moral conundrum at some level here. What about the people who don't want their food to be messed with, for whatever reason that might be, whether it's a conspiracy theory or whether there's a principle by which they live? Should that stop us from fortifying food, or is it a question of weighing the risks and the benefits?
I don't think that these people should be railroaded into accepting things that they're not comfortable with. And the current food fortification system allows for that. So even with flour fortification that's been going on for decades in this country, we only fortify white flour. We don't fortify whole grain flour. And there's two reasons for that. One is some people don't want fortification, therefore they have the ability to buy whole grain flour and not have any fortification. But secondly, because whole grain flour contains the parts of the cereal that are removed during refining, they actually contain a lot more vitamins and minerals anyway. So the bran is actually a very valuable thing. A bit like, you know, eat the skin on your carrots and eat the skin on your apple. Maybe not the orange, absolutely, but you know, definitely the apple. And that is giving you extra vitamins and minerals, and it's exactly the same with cereal food. So if you go for the whole grain version, you will not have any fortification. Looking at breakfast cereals, if you have your natural oats or many types of muesli, or if you make muesli at home, you will not have any fortification in that.
Okay, so I think we're sort of broadly celebrating the idea of food fortification, but let's also sort of just draw ourselves back from the excitement for a second. What are the limitations of food fortification? You've mentioned a few things already, but if you could make it a little bit clearer.
Yeah, so in order for food fortification to be successful, you have to pick the right vehicle. So it has to be a foodstuff that is widely eaten or eaten by your target population. So if you think about folic acid, for example, here we're targeting women of childbearing age because that's where the issues with low folic acid are occurring. It's in pregnancies. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, more than 90% of women of childbearing age in the UK are currently deficient in folic acid compared with where we need them to be to have healthy pregnancies. So that's a sobering thought. So you have to have a food that is eaten by your target population, that is eaten in sufficient quantities to make a difference. But then it also has to be in a bioavailable format. So you need to make sure that whichever nutrient you're putting in there is going to be absorbed by the body and that other things in the food are not going to inhibit that. For example, things like calcium can inhibit absorption of some nutrients, fiber can inhibit the absorption of iron. So you wouldn't want to put iron into something that was massively high in fibre because it's not so much of it's going to get absorbed. Another point as well is making sure that the foodstuff isn't something that we're trying to reduce in our diets. So that's one of the reasons why we don't fortify table sugar. And unlike America, we haven't agreed to iodized salt in the UK, even though we do actually have a problem, again, with young girls and women with low iodine levels. And low iodine during pregnancy can lead to poor cognitive development in the fetus and an infant. So you want to make sure that there's enough iodine, but we would not consider fortifying salt, because that is something as a population that we're trying to reduce. So there's certainly, it's not a simple matter of just picking something, you know, like, oh, everybody has cake, let's just stick things in cake, because that's not acceptable from a broader public health
stance. My
duck
fat comes with extra iron in. Yeah, it's not going to work, is it? Okay, well, let's get a little bit more specific. Here in the UK, the government is proposing that some of our bread should be fortified with folic acid. So first of all, why folic acid? I mean, you've given us some basics about it, how do you feel about this? Is it a good idea?
Yeah, definitely. So in 1991, the Medical Research Council of the UK highlighted the issue with low folate levels and spina bifida and other neural tube disorders, and said really what we needed to do was to get folic acid into flour. It had already been done in America, Canada, and many other countries around the globe. But as usual, Britain has to plough its own furrow, and it can be a little bit stubborn, and we've got to look at all the evidence ourselves. And then you get civil society involved, where you've got, you know, groups of people saying, I don't want this for whatever reason. So I'm so disappointed. It's taken us more than 30 years to actually get to the point. I know it's so they've actually had a consultation now, but I've not seen the results of that. And I don't know what is going to happen and whether anything actually will happen before the election. But it definitely does need to happen. The reason that they picked folic acid, as I mentioned a moment ago, more than 90% of women of childbearing age in this country don't have enough folic acid or folate, as the natural source of it's called, in their bodies to sustain an optimal healthy pregnancy. So it really is an urgent matter. And I mean, don't you find it amazing, Stefan, that in this country where we talk about obesity and sugar all the time, we do have people that have nutrient deficiencies in a land of plenty. So we do need to do something about it, and I wish they would just get on with it.
It does seem bizarre that it doesn't happen. I mean, and there's also been some suggestion that what's being proposed doesn't go far enough, that there's not going to be enough folic acid in the end product to make much of a difference. But how does that work? How does that unfold for you?
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think it's better to get started on it. And you do have to be extremely careful and cautious when adding nutrients into foods that are going to be eaten by millions of people. And I agree with what we call the precautionary method that we quite often use in public health, where we obviously don't want to do any harm. And I would much rather that we just got it underway with the levels that are already being proposed after very careful consideration by expert bodies. And if we need to adjust it at some point in the future, then let's do it. I know that there are some medical professionals and campaigners out there who are saying, no, we need a different level. But in my mind, that's just going to delay it another 10 years. I would rather we just got on with it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Is there anything else? Are there any other sort of low-hanging fruits, as it were, not fruits at all, any other low-hanging fortification potentials that you'd like to see added to food stuff, other vitamins and other key nutrients, or other foods that are good targets for fortification?
Well, I mean, I'd definitely like to see more vitamin D added. The news recently, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, said that we're having over 300 children admitted to hospital in a year with rickets. Now, rickets was almost completely got rid of in this country.
Yeah.
I know, exactly. Yeah. And it's because the ethnic mix of our country has changed, because most of the vitamin D we have in our bodies comes from sun exposure during the summer and autumn months. And if you come from a culture where you cover up your skin, perhaps stay indoors more, perhaps have a lengthy breastfeeding, then you do have vitamin D depletion in a particular community. And we need to do something about that. So it has been mooted that we could add vitamin D to chapati flour, for example, so that certain communities who are at higher risk of vitamin D deficiency are able to get a source of vitamin D. We do recommend supplementation all year round for people from certain ethnic groups and for the rest of us to take in the autumn and winter months. And that's 10 micrograms a day. But the uptake of supplementation is really poor. There's only about a third of people that are taking these supplements as recommended. And many of the harder to reach communities are just not using them at all. So I think something like vitamin D, either adding it to particular foods eaten by ethnic groups or adding it to something like yogurt, because yogurt is a great food. It naturally contains calcium anyway. So by fortifying it with vitamin D, then you're getting the combination of nutrients, which is really good for bone health, because there are many roles for vitamin D in the body. But the main one is actually bone health throughout life, whether it's a child growing up and needing strong bones, or when you get to my age in life, you're really trying to hang on to the bone that you've got and try to avoid osteoporosis. So
you
it's,
and me both.
It's actually, I know, it's a universal nutrient that really could benefit people from all ages. They're all already adding it to some yogurts and also some breakfast cereals, but it would be good to get more vitamin D into the diet.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what's your view on the concept of mandatory fortification? I mean, it's a top-down approach. Presumably, you know, you need a level playing field for the industry to do it. I mean, I'm struggling to see any downsides to it. But is there any pushback from the industry?
Yes, there is pushback from the industry, actually, but it's mostly to do with cost rather than any particular belief about it. So mandatory fortification is better than voluntary in a way, because it helps manage the risks. Because if you're mandating that certain foods are fortified to a particular level, then you know how much of the nutrient is being delivered to a population. Whereas if you have it voluntary and anybody can fortify anything they want at whatever level, you're then looking at quite a variety of levels that might be consumed by the population, which could lead to excessive intakes in some groups. So I think mandatory is better. There is pushback. So in a recent consultation, business was 56% in favour of the folic acid fortification, but actually heritage milling industry was only 35% in favour. So maybe these are people being smaller businesses are thinking, oh, what a hassle, because it's going to be more cost to the business. They're going to have to buy the stuff, stick it in the flour. They're going to have to then be audited to make sure that the right amount is in there. They're going to have to change all their... It's all costs. They're going to have to change their labelling. So probably the larger companies feel able to absorb that cost more than smaller companies. But overall, there was around about 55% in favour of mandatory fortification. And people have got used to it. I mean, look at all the other stuff we add into flour, the B vitamins and the calcium. That's been well accepted, and nobody mutters about that anymore.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting. So when I did my TV series all about e-numbers, one of the interesting things that unfolded was that, and which I don't think anyone really thought of in the public, and I hadn't thought of, was that everyone thinks that food companies want to throw loads of e-numbers into food. That it's an easy way. But you've got to remember the food additive. You know, the folic acid. This thing is probably the most expensive aspect of the food, but most expensive ingredient that's in there. So I would imagine. Yeah, you're right. A lot of the food industry is thinking, hang on, I've got to pay for this stuff, and that must sort of be a bit of a drawback.
Yes, absolutely. And I thought of another nutrient it would be good to add in, and that's fibre, because you'll remember the 2015 report about sugar and fibre. And of course, sugar took all the attention. Everybody's still talking about it to this day. But fibre in that report, which was equally important, seems to have been forgotten. Now, there's a lot of us that don't like eating high fibre foods. We maybe don't recognise where to find it in our diets. But there are lots of very interesting fibre ingredients now. So if you think about something like beta-glucan, which you get from oats, and different types of brands like barley bran and so on that can get added in, these produce health benefits, either helping you feel fuller for longer. It's good for your bowel and gut health. And in some cases, it can reduce your blood cholesterol as well and help your heart health. So it'd be really, really good to get more fiber ingredients. I mean, even things like the prebiotics, inulin and oligofructose into these products, because the consumers will then find it easier to eat fiber, and they don't specifically have to go out and buy bran flakes or particular food. They can maybe get their fiber in a yogurt or even a biscuit, if you know, in the future, if we put our minds to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So last question really then is a slightly more complicated one. And that is, what would you like to see from the food industry in regard to fortification? I mean, should they be proactive? Should they be pushing for changes, for the introduction of folic acid? Or is there just going to be a weary acceptance of it from the food industry? Is there something more that the food industry can do?
I think it's informing themselves, because I do feel that from a mandatory perspective, it needs to come from the officials. It needs to come from the independent scientific bodies who will look at the benefits and risks in a very sober kind of non-commercial way, and then suggest it. Then it's for the industry to work with government and these bodies on the practical aspects, because nobody knows better than the industry of how to actually make foods at scale. And I feel that sometimes there's a bit of a mismatch in knowledge, where people in government and in these campaigning groups, they haven't got any hard experience of working in the food industry. So, you know, they do have misconceptions. So I think the food industry can bring a lot of practical experience to the table and real know-how of putting things into action, because it's actually the food industry that feeds the nation. You know, the farmers do their role, they're part of the food industry too, and the manufacturers and the retailers. You know, very, very few of us are growing carrots in our garden anymore, and we don't have our cow in the garden to go and milk. So we do rely on the food industry, and I feel that they have a huge amount of practical knowledge and experience to bring to the table.
Yeah. Kerry, I've got to say, it is always such a joy talking to you. You are measured, you're clear, you're fabulously informative, and you're fun to talk to as well. So thank you so much for taking a subject that could, on the surface, have sounded really, really boring, and making it absolutely brilliant. Dr. Kerry Ruxton, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you for listening to that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, I'd like to tell you about an event where you can experience the latest food innovation firsthand. It's called Tastes of Better, and it's a one-of-a-kind event for product developers to discover value-adding ingredients, enhancing everything from flavour, texture and mouthfeel to shelf life, nutrition, sustainability and cost efficiency. Check your eligibility and apply for a seat at the table over at the Food Matters Live website.